We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. Of the 20 most costly catastrophes since 1970, more than half have occurred since 2001. And looking at that, many people ask this question, well, is that some kind of a fluke? Or as we go forward here in the near term, should we expect this kind of pace of unexpected big events should continue? And I think that there are people say the answer to that question is yes, we should expect it, to see more of these kinds of catastrophic, big, unpredictable events. And then the question is, well, how do we meet these things? And the fact is that human decision-making, if we're confronted with a problem that we've seen before, well, we don't do too badly. But if we come across something that's really unexpected, that acts differently, our tendency may be to do what we've done in the past, and that does not always work very well. We'll try to talk a little bit this morning about decision-making, what we know about human decision-making on an individual basis, and then how that translates to how it is as a society we try to respond to these sorts of big challenges. And our guest is Erwin Michel Curgeon. He teaches at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, where his work is focused on managing and financing extreme events, primarily natural disasters and terrorism risk. He is also managing director of the Wharton Risk Center, which now for a quarter century has been at the forefront of research into the management of extreme events. And he is one of the editors, co-editor, of a recently published book that's titled The Irrational Economist. The subtitle is Making Decisions in a Dangerous World. It's published by Public Affairs Books, and it brings together essays, contributions by a number of scholars from various kinds of disciplines, looking at these questions that I've mentioned here, how it is that people make decisions, how it is that decision-making is sometimes flawed, not up to meeting big challenges, and then how that translates into, as a society, how we deal with big issues. The book is out now, so if you're interested in looking at it, I'm sure that you can find it. Questions here on the program are welcome to. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call, and we certainly welcome calls, the number here locally, 333-9455. We have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We'll also take your emails at will-talk. It's just like it sounds, W-I-L-L, will-talk at illinois.edu. We hope that people will make their comments brief, but certainly people who are listening are welcome to join the conversation. Dr. Michel Curgeon, hello.
Hi, good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Happy to be here.
Let me just ask again, or have you talk a little bit about this basic issue here of the number of these big, unexpected, unforeseen catastrophes that we've seen, and whether or not we should expect that in the decades ahead, we will continue to see these at the pace that we now have recently. You think, in fact, we should expect there to be more major disasters in the years ahead?
I think we'll see many more of them. That's the bad news. I think what is really lying in front of us is, better understanding why that's the case. Mm-hmm. And when you understand why that's the case, what can you do to not only prevent these large-scale events, but also better recover from them and limit the exposure. So, why is that happening? Well, for different reasons. If you take natural disasters as one example, whether it's earthquake, and we've seen with Haiti and in Chile over the past few weeks, earthquake, hurricane, storm, floods, you name it. I think what's happening, especially here in the U.S., is that you have more people living in what we call high-risk areas, namely the coast of the country. About 35-40% of the U.S. population is now living in one of the coastal states, which obviously are more exposed to hurricanes and storm surge than before. So bottom line, the same hurricane that will have happened, let's say, in 100 years ago will have much more impact today, and even more so 10-15 years from now, because we'll have more people living in these areas and more cars and more houses to be destroyed. So mathematically, we'll see more of these catastrophe happen in the next few years, that's for sure. If you move from natural catastrophe to pandemics, for instance, you realize that viruses fly business class too. And by that, I mean we are living in a very interconnected world. So pandemic starting in Asia could be on our desk in Europe or in the U.S., here in the U.S., in 40, 48 hours max. On terrorism, that's the same thing. The nature of terrorism threat has radically evolved over the past 20 years. And so all of that being combined, you basically have the seat of a much more dangerous world than 20 or 25 years ago.
Mm-hmm. I'm very struck by something. One of the things that I know that you have been involved in is the global risks reports that have been issued by the World Economic Forum. Yep. And if people are interested in looking at this, they've been coming out for a number of years. There's a new one out now that's the Global Risks Report 2010, and it's online. And if people want to look at it, all they have to do is, you know, whatever browser they use, just put in Global Risks 2010, and they'll get it. And I'm just here taking a look at the executive summary for this report. And I guess one of the things that really strikes me here is it notes that some of the biggest risks facing the world today, in the words of the report, may be from slow failures or creeping risks. And just with the kind of things that you're talking about here, is it makes me think about how many things are the result of trends that maybe have been playing out over a long period of time that we really haven't been paying attention to until they build to the point where they have these big consequences.
Well, I think that's a great way to look at that. People tend to think, and that's one of the purposes of the Irrational Economy, the book we are going to talk about, is to better understand what is behavioral aspect behind these catastrophic risk management. Just for your listeners, it has been about 5 years now that the World Economic Forum, working with the Wharton School of Risk Management and the Decision Processing Center here at the University of Pennsylvania, have been putting these short report together. And the purpose of the report of the World Economic Forum is pretty simple. We try to take a 5 to 10 year horizon on what could happen in the next 5 to 10 years. We all know we tend to be very myopic. We all tend to think about the next week, the next month, the next quarter, if you're on Wall Street. Rarely you have the luxury to think 5 or 10 years ahead. When you do so, you see things coming from very far because you start better understanding the effect of some of your action today, or that will be the effect 10 or 20 years from now. One good example of that is how poorly we have treated our critical infrastructure in the U.S. Mm. We had worldwide we had the best infrastructures back in the 50s, no question about that. But, our level of investment has been pretty slow. And now I just came back from a few months ago. I was in China and Thailand, and just comparing high-speed trains in China and comparing trends in the U.S. is just a major difference. And China will win that battle if we don't do more.
Our guest, let me just very quickly again introduce the guest for this hour, Erwin Michel Kerjant. He is Managing Director of the Risk Management and Decision Processes Center at the Wharton School. That's at the University of Pennsylvania, where he does work and research. He is particularly interested in managing and financing extreme events, particularly natural disasters and terrorism risk. And he is one of the editors of a recently published book. The title is The Irrational Economist, Making Decisions in a Dangerous World. It's published by Public Affairs Books. And it contains a number of essays but by scholars in different areas trying to look at human decision-making and then how it is that the way that we tend to think as individuals can translate into decisions that we make for entire societies. And questions certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we also have that email. You can call or you can write to us at will-talk at illinois.edu. A big section of the book here, maybe about half of the book, does take a look at individuals and their decision-making. And there is, apparently for a long time, there was an assumption, particularly by economists, that people did behave in a rational and predictable sort of way. And it seems that some of our more recent research really calls that into question. And perhaps not so much saying that people are it's not, as I think you suggest here in the introduction, not so much whether people are rational or irrational. That maybe is not the right question. But the question is, well, in what circumstances does our decision-making work pretty well, and in what circumstances does it not?
Well, precisely. I mean, that was, if I may say a word about the book, that book came out from really 40 years of research in what we call now behavioral economics. And the idea behind behavioral economics is to try to do a better job at representing how you and me as individuals or decision makers are making decisions every day. I mean, some of these decisions are very simple. You take sugar in your coffee and, you know, I mean, that's not a big deal. But obviously other decisions are more important, like should I build my house in a high-risk flood area, for instance, or what type of protection measure should I put on my house or my building? So what we've tried to do in the book, and that's a book co-edited with my friend and colleague Paul Slovic, who is one of the world-leading psychologists today. And Paul has been studying these issues of risk and decision-making for about 40 or 50 years now. And what we decided to do in the book is to say, well, behavioral economics has been here for like 20, 30 years now. What have we learned from that? And what have we learned for questions that really matters to many of us, not just should I select the blue mug or the right one. And a lot of that has been discussed in other books. What we try to do in the irrational economics is really to go one step further, saying, well, let's apply this knowledge to important questions. So that's basically what this is about. And we invited 30 of the leading economists, social scientists, psychologists, several of them received the Nobel Prize, to write very short chapters that could be understandable for lay person, so you don't have to be a specialist to understand what we're talking about. Actually, the book starts on the role of superstition, so we go pretty far with that, by Tom Schilling. Tom received the Nobel Prize 4 years ago in economics. So that's, in a way, that's a fun book to read about issues that really matters. So to come back to your question, and Dave, on that aspect, that's correct. The question, the debate is not so much about rationality versus irrationality, because obviously it depends on where you see it. Some action will look like very irrational for you because you tend to disagree with that person. Or if someone doing something that's similar to what you're doing, you think that person is rational. So it's a matter of perspective, really. I think it's fair to say that we are well-trained to behave and make decisions in a very certain world when the question is well-posed, when the answer is pretty straightforward, and we feel good about that. It's much more difficult for us to do good decision-making process when there is a lot of uncertainty around the situation we're in, and when we're not quite sure about what could be the potential implications over time of our action today. That's what the book is about.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it strikes me that one of the potential issues here, one of the potential problems is that, in fact, we really don't like uncertainty. We don't like it at all. I think that sometimes we tend to want to try to simplify problems that are very complicated, and that's not a good way to get at a good solution. Although in the near term, that might do something to make us feel a little easier because it makes things seem to be more certain than they are. But the fact of the matter is, there is a lot of uncertainty. I guess then maybe the question becomes: well, how do we manage the feelings of discomfort that come with that level of uncertainty and this feeling that what we've done in the past is not going to work in the future?
Well, I mean, you're raising a few good questions here. Well, I think the first one is to realize that, yes, this is correct, that we, most of us at least, feel somewhat uncomfortable dealing with uncertainty. And it's not just you and me. Many people, if you do surveys, you realize people do. So, I mean, first of all, realize that there is a difference between what you know for sure and what you're not quite certain about. And that's just normal. I insist on the term. It's just normal to feel that way. When you do that, you're already halfway because you recognize that, I mean, that may be a different world that, in which you have to make different decisions. The next question obviously becomes your second one, which is, well, what do you do about that? And maybe it's too complex for me to handle. I don't think that's the case. I think you just need to realize that there are things you can do, not do, and maybe to access other experts in the discipline so you better understand what's going on. Same way that if you feel sick, unless you train as a medical doctor, typically what you do, you get to see a medical doctor whose knowledge is higher than yours on with different symptoms or disease. So, I mean, that's exactly the same thing on these catastrophes. And you need to talk to people who have been looking at these for many years. They're not new. Earthquake and natural catastrophes, terrorism, pandemics are not new threats. What is new is the scale at which they seem to occur and how fast it seems to happen, at least over the past decade.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. Someone who is in Urbana, and this is line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I wonder, if I ran a few assumptions by you that you could challenge if you like, and then maybe address my thought about it. If we thought of strategy as being a calculated relationship between ends and means, and then we specifically thought about terrorism as a threat and how to counter it, my suggestion is that we've got so much invested resource-wise in a military solution to, like, the terrorist problem that even if it's rational to take another tack, like, say, to use a more humanitarian approach, we've got so much invested in our military approach that it might not even be more efficient to go another approach. How then do you assess the effectiveness of a strategy with respect to the momentum of what our current strategy is? Do you want to run that one, or do you care to talk about that?
Yeah. Well, that's thanks. That's a complex issue.
Sorry.
Sure. That's a great question. I think it's fair to say that. We need to approach terrorism threat, we as a society, not only the U.S., but originally coming from France, that I've seen several terrorist attacks in Paris and elsewhere as well, to better understand, I mean, there is terrorists and terrorists. There are different type of terrorist organizations. They have different mood of attacks, different goals and aims, as you mentioned. So you need to better understand who are you talking about. Are you talking about Al-Qaeda only, or are you talking about Hamas and other international terrorist organization. So first of all, you need to understand who is your enemy, and then you start thinking about what are the different strategies. Typically, what we've seen is that rarely in history a single strategy has been enough to tackle terrorist threat. Typically, it's a combination of different strategies, one being military strategies, the other one being diplomacy, and the third one being trying to increase the level of education of some of these countries to help them to help more people realize that engaging in terrorist activities is not the best thing they could do. But obviously, again, that's complex because terrorist organizations in India are somewhat different than in the Middle East. So you have to better understand who are the enemies and what type of different strategy you can use. At the end of the day, it's not just the U.S. being involved militarily. It's really the rest of the world working with the U.S. to tackle that threat. We know for sure that even if Al-Qaeda is somewhat weakened today, there are ideologies not over, so that threat will not go away very soon.
Could I be more specific?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What I guess I'm really suggesting to some extent is that because of how much we've invested over the years and at the present in our military forces, that precludes other tactics and strategies. And I'm wondering how much do you think that distorts any rational or more sophisticated approach? I mean, it really was maybe some half our GDP on defense or some crazy number like that. So what I'm saying is that how distorting do you think that is, and do you think really how much of a place do you think intelligent, rational, sophisticated thinking really plays in this? Okay, I'll leave it at that. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, well, I'm not sure whether, I may repeat it myself. I think that's correct that we have invested and continue to invest a lot of money for the good. I mean, we haven't seen another terrorist attack on U.S. soil over the past 8 to 9 years now since 9/11. So in a way, that's working. Obviously, it's hard because if nothing happened on U.S. soil, people are like, yeah, maybe we should be more relaxed. And if something happened, we start blaming the head of the Department of Homeland Security for not doing his job or her job. So, again, I think we can combine, and the U.S. has definitely been combining different approaches. I don't think because we have invested so much in military spending to Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere that we should not do anything on the diplomacy side. I think we should continue to use diplomacy as well. Mm-hmm. And combine different responses.
Well, it seems to me that you could substitute some other problem here, and the question would continue to stand. And I suppose that gets at, maybe at this connection between individuals and their tendencies to confront novel problems with the same kinds of behaviors that they've used before. It maybe the same thing applies to societies, to governments. That is, this is how we have behaved in the past. This is how we've acted in the past. These are the structures that we have, and maybe some new problem comes along, but we continue to try to meet it the way that we have in the past, and that makes it, I'm sure, difficult to change. Particularly when you have institutional structures that are in place and have been in place for some time.
No, absolutely. I mean, that's a very fair point. I mean, as I like to say, we tend to fight the last war, and rightly so. And by rightly, I mean, because unless you start thinking strategically about what could happen tomorrow, if something somewhat similar to what happened occurred tomorrow, you're going to, the only reference point you have is what you've done in the past, and also learning from mistakes you made in the past, but not necessarily realizing that the context, the assumptions you're making are just radically different than what happened a few years back. I think that's true for terrorist organization to some extent. I think for natural catastrophes, it's less true. I mean, we know what a hurricane looks like. We know what an earthquake looks like, a flood looks like. So I think there is more to it. And by that, I mean the fact that people are not necessarily doing the right thing to protect themselves. There is more to it than just that notion of fighting the last war. We spend a lot of time in the book trying to better understand why is that people just don't do things that you will expect them to do. And one example I use in the book is the fact that there was a survey done by the New York Times about 8 months after Hurricane Katrina in 2006. The survey was done in 2006. They interviewed like 1,000 residents from coastal areas in the U.S., asking them, well, after Katrina, you know what a hurricane could do. What have you done to make your house on the beach more secure? And 85% of them responded saying that they had not done anything. And you're like, what's going on? Are they irrational? They don't understand the risks? Yes, they do. Just like people are, as I mentioned before, very myopic. We tend to forget very fast.
Yeah. Well, I think that's an excellent example. And even after it is proven that someone might have built their house in a very vulnerable area and then something happens and it gets destroyed, not only do we have people who are in areas that are potentially vulnerable that maybe aren't preparing themselves, we have areas where people had lived that were vulnerable, that were damaged, and they want to go back and do it all over again, which, again, you might have to say, well, I can understand you might be attached to this place, but really it doesn't make a great deal of sense to go right back there and to build again what you had and again in this extremely vulnerable place, except that people do that.
Well, I mean, what you're describing is a rational way of looking at these things. I tend to agree with that description. At the same time, we all have to realize that, I mean, taking New Orleans as one example, if that's the one you had in mind, yeah, that's true. People have been living there for years, from generation to generation, that are really attached to the city. And you can try to teach them about the exposure in a very rational way. At the end of the day, the emotion, the attachment to their cities is much higher than any risk they are facing. And unless you balance the two, you don't understand why they are behaving that way. For everybody else not living in New Orleans, this is just crazy to go back there after not only Katrina, but other hurricanes that happened there in the past. But people do. And we've seen, as I mentioned, I was in Asia a few months ago. We've seen that in Asia as well. China had a major earthquake back in 2008, and people are going back exactly at the same place. People have short memory. And the other thing I should mention, too, is that unless you have been through one of these catastrophes, you don't necessarily realize the emotional aspect attached to it. It's very hard. So if you have been through the catastrophe, typically you react in a more rational way, being more preventive. If you've seen that on TV, you don't feel the emotion in the same way. So that's a big difference as well.
Our guest, Erwin Michel-Cajant, teaches at the Wharton School at University of Pennsylvania. He is also managing director of the Wharton Risk Center, which has now for a quarter century been leading research into the management of extreme events. He is the co-editor, along with psychologist Paul Slovic from University of Oregon. They're the co-editors of the book, The Irrational Economist, Making Decisions in a Dangerous World. It is published by Public Affairs Books, and it's a collection of writing by various social scientists, taking a look at some of these questions that we're talking about this morning. That is, what is it? What are the factors that shape individual decision-making? And then how is it that translates into societal decision-making, particularly when it comes to trying to confront and perhaps prepare for big shocks? And we could be talking about economic disasters. We could be talking about natural disasters. We could talk about terrorism, something that we've seen a lot of in the past decade, and the expectation is that we will see more of that in the future, and that we should expect to be living in a world where the level of uncertainty is rising. So the question is, how do we meet that? How do we prepare for these challenges? Questions are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455 and email will-talk@illinois.edu. A couple of other callers here. Atlanta, Illinois up next. This is line 4. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. Great conversation. The question I have revolves around something that we've kind of touched on the edges, or you've touched on the edges of, but maybe we could address a little bit more in the fact all these other disasters might cause a really big disaster that I think that we could probably, through education, maybe temper a little bit, and that's civil disobedience. That could be caused by terrorism or by political or by all kind of other disasters, and I think that's something we're probably really ill-prepared to take into account.
Well, that's a great point, and we have seen that, a little bit in the U.S., but not that much, but in many other countries for sure. I think it's fair to say that if and I'm talking about your education aspect, I think it's fair to say that if you look at our curriculum for children today, we don't have any course at any level on risk management, like basic risk management preparedness, and that's pretty amazing. When you think about that, it's not only in the U.S., but you don't have that in Europe either. And if the world is becoming more dangerous, you need to better teach kids and children and teenagers and eventually adults how to behave, quote-unquote, in that risky environment. So I think education, that's right, education has a major role to play here, but you need to slightly revamp the curriculum.
I agree, and I was thinking along those same lines that we definitely haven't done that. And if people knew how to behave, like you just said, through a lot of variety of disasters, it sure would work a lot better. And thank you for your comments.
No, sure. Thanks for your question.
Thank you. Over to Belgium, Illinois, line number 1. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. I have a question. How can you make any decisions about risk management when you have an organism that will continue to make the same mistake over and over again? And when I like to point out an example like this is, a very close one is the healthcare we're dealing with today. And we know we have to do something about it, but there are means that keep pushing it in one direction. We can take the situation with Israel, where they have an idea. They want one piece of property, and they continue this idea for 50 years now, just continually causing more and more problems, which cause more and more problems all over the world. And then 175 years ago, we make decisions on drug policy. We continue them along. We know there's problems in every way, but we keep making the same mistakes over and over again. How can you possibly manage risk when people are going to do that?
Well, that's a hard one, but no, that's great. That's a great question too. I think at some point we as a society have to realize that we have to make tough decisions. And talking to leaders of our country, whether it's president or Congress, that yeah, when you make tough decisions, you will make many, many people very unhappy. You will make enemies. People will not like you for the rest of your life. But you have to stand up for something. You have to stand up for your ideas and say, well, I think that's the right thing to do given our knowledge of the situation today, given the non-decisions we have made over the past 75 years in the drug case or several decades in the healthcare system. And we have to make some of these decisions. The easy path is obviously to postpone that. If you're elected for 4 years and re-elected for another 4 years, you can just always postpone that to the next president, to take that example, saying, well, you know, politically it's maybe like a ticking bomb if I touch that. And we've seen that with President Clinton when Hillary Clinton, the first lady at that time, started trying to revamp the healthcare system. That was politically a no-go, and she just stopped. And now President Obama is taking over again. I hope we'll see changes made, even if there are small changes. At least small changes indicate the right direction. But bottom line, that's a trade-off between doing simple things or not doing anything today because the short-term reward would be much better for yourself versus making tough decisions and making this decision knowing that people won't be necessarily happy with you in that decision, but for a better society in the next few years. And again, on all of these issues, and the book, several of the contributors to the book tackle these issues as well, short-term versus long-term. And unless you start balancing the short-term versus long-term argument, you don't go anywhere, and we can have that discussion again 25 years from now. But, you know, so at some point someone has to stand up, say, I'm going to make tough decisions, and that's what we call a leader.
Thank you very much.
All right, let's go on to someone in Maple Park here, line number 4. Hello.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
There's so much negativity out there. I have learned to turn the TV off and sometimes the radio off to not listen to he or she or whatever they're saying because it's their version of whatever side they're on. And I think that's a problem with this country. They tend to listen to other people outside of listening to themselves. You know, so... you know, the positive, I choose to be positive on stuff. Now, I have called on different occasions on this radio station, as Dave is well fully aware of. I kind of, the northern half of the state, big mouth here. But I work with basically things that only affect me and people around me and trying to, you know, average Joe type of situation, whether it be the economy or the healthcare or just teaching, you know, kids in school. What I find fascinating and really kind of outrageous is that schools, every time you turn around, are crying about money. And yet we get no better, if anything, worse. And I you know, I'm 53. Now, why can't we go back to when we were, you know, in the 70s and the 80s? Where we are teaching these kids something outside of being biased one way or the other. It's, you know, if you look at the way everything has been done, it's all about money. I mean, it's money, 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 money. And, you know, the baby boomers are all retiring now. That's another big issue. You know, there's a big swath of those people retiring. So where's the money going? So everybody wants what everybody else has. In other words, the Joneses situation. And, you know, one thing leads on to another and to another. And without going long about this, the whole point is people need to start respecting other people's lives and property and start being courteous to people and just, you know, ignore what our politicians say, because I all personally believe they all have a motive for themselves and not the rest of us. I kind of call them liars, cheats, and thieves, but that's my personal opinion. And I think that has a lot to do with today's society. But I'll let you go so you can comment. Thank you.
Well, there's a lot of different ways you could go on that. I'm not sure what of that you would like to take and run with, if anything.
Yeah, well, let me say just one thing. I mean, related to the book, I think the how this country is getting more polarized today is obviously something we have to overcome if we want to go further. On the book, on any book, you always have some endorsement on the back cover of the book, and on purpose, we have asked two great minds to endorse the book. One is clearly a Republican, the other one is clearly a Democrat, and both were the former chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers at the White House under two different presidents. So this is not an answer, but I mean, there are ways you can be balanced if you hear what other part of the chess play, if I can say that, I have to say. So you can be Democrats deeply, but also understand what Republicans have to say, because they may have a point in something, and vice versa. So I mean, I would stop here, because otherwise, getting too much into detail here.
Well, I find myself thinking about a basic question, and we should not be surprised that most of the time, what people will be concerned about is their immediate life and their families and their communities. And that's the way that they're going to look at problems. They're going to look at problems through that lens of how does this affect me in a very immediate sort of a way. And I guess it gets me back to something we were talking a little bit about earlier, where I mentioned that in the risk, this report on risks 2010, you said that some of the biggest risks facing the world today are from slow failures or creeping risks. They're these things that are the result of trends that play themselves over a long period of time. They go very slowly. And it's hard to, you know, when your concerns really are what's happening with me, my family, and my community today, tomorrow, and next week, it's pretty hard to think about things that maybe are going to have some effect 5 years from now or 10 years from now or 50 years from now, particularly if it has some cost to me where I don't seem to see some immediate benefit. And it seems to me that that's a big hurdle that you have to get over.
No, that's true, and it's not irrational. I think it's fair to say that, I mean, you and me and all your listeners, a day just 24 hours, and honestly, we have a lot to do already. Hard job if we're lucky to have a job in this economy, or searching for a new job if we lost our job, taking care of the kids, taking care of family members, making sure that the health is good for all the family members. So all of that is already 20 hours of your day. So you don't really have a lot of time to think outside the box if your box is local. At the same time, I think people understand today more than ever that we are living in a very interdependent society today that across states, across countries. So as we mentioned in the book, in a way, in this growing interdependent world, being selfish means also taking care of others you don't necessarily know, because the failure to do good risk management could have an impact on you tomorrow. You know, in a way, you could say, well, I don't really care about what people in Mexico are doing, because they're very far from my house in Illinois. Well, that's true for some part, but that's untrue for others. I mean, if you're not looking at what they're doing, and then you have a bird flu coming out of Mexico, and it could be on your desk tomorrow, well, maybe you should pay more attention to what Mexico is doing. So I think more and more people are realizing that, yeah, it's very natural to concentrate on your family members and yourself. I mean, that's where you start. At the same time, maybe you can rebalance a little bit the time you're spending thinking about these issues. Instead of being 100% me, could be like 90% me and my family members, and 10% trying to better understand other people, not only in the U.S., but in other countries as well. Mm-hmm. We're living in a small planet today.
Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Erwan Michel Kerjean. He's Managing Director of the Risk Management and Decision Processes Center at the Wharton School at University of Pennsylvania. And in his work, is particularly interested in how we manage and how we finance extreme events, primarily things like natural disasters and terrorism risk. He is also the co-editor of a recent book. It's titled The Irrational Economist Making Decisions in a Dangerous World. It is published by Public Affairs Books, and it has a number of articles by a number of leading social scientists, particularly economists, that take a look basically at two things. That is how individuals behave when they're dealing with crisis and big, serious, novel situations, and then how individual behavior translates into collective actions or maybe lack of actions on the levels of societies and governments. Questions welcome. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Let's go to Effingham next. Line four. Hello.
Yes. Thanks for taking my call. I'd like to pose a couple of questions and then hang on if I might. Your guest and others, you know, I listen to this program as much as I can, and I keep hearing symptoms described about human conditions and social affairs and the whole spectrum of that engagement that humans have. And when do we get to the bottom of the problem? I would like to interject this now. What does your guest think of society that is organized by patriarchs and has been so, you know, throughout written history and prehistoric times? And if he has any knowledge or expertise of the symptoms that reoccur and the patriarchs who actually dominate and steer society, whether it's over seismic faults or into crowded areas where disease that he just described, now, you know, with travel and all that sort of thing, that's become international. And I wonder if he might have a comment about that.
Well, I don't know. I think that's fairly...
Maybe straight. I don't have any expertise on that very point, so I'm going to pass on that one. But if you have another question, I'm happy to take it.
Yeah, I don't. I think that's more than we can do in this conversation. Is there something that's maybe a little bit more more down to earth that we could do?
Well, that's a nexus of the problem, and if it can't be answered, then we're dead. Thanks.
Well, all right. There, we would just.
I thought the question will be, if I may just use that one.
Yes.
Well, we've talked a lot about the fact that people are not, you know, behaving the way they should, but what can we do to make them behave or us behave differently? If there had been that question, I think the book spent a lot of time doing just that, not just talking about the symptoms, but what type of prescription can we do? Because, you know what, it's nice to scare people, say, well, we'll see more and more catastrophes, but unless I give you a few examples of what you could do to be better prepared, we're not going to be very far. So let me say a few words about that, and then we can take another question if
yes.
you don't mind. Well, I think first of all is that recognition that, yeah, that could happen to me, and many people think that will not happen to you, but that could happen to you. If you're living in a house for 20 years, the probability of having a flood, someone in Illinois is pretty high. It's not 100%, but it's pretty high. So do you have flood insurance? I mean, think about the day after a catastrophe and ask yourself, do I have the right protection to do it? And if you don't, just do it. I mean, typically when you ask people, do you have like 2 or 3 days of food supply in your apartment, in your house, just in case there is a major flood, a major earthquake, a major storm, the answer is no. So first of all, get some food. Second, get some cash. People don't realize that, you know, if you lose electricity, there is no ATM machine. Gas pump don't work anymore. So your entire wall is stopped for a moment unless you have some small bills. So it's a very concrete way to go through these natural catastrophes, at least. Think about insurance protection. Do you have coverage on your house? And obviously there is a cost to it, but do you have coverage on your house for that type of catastrophic event? And if you don't, ask yourself, well, how is going to, my family is going to go through this natural catastrophe if I don't have financial coverage? Do I have enough money in my bank account to pay for $20,000, $30,000, $50,000 loss on my house. If you don't, you should contemplate some financial coverage. So these are like very simple things for you to do, but you have to do it properly and talk to your wife and husband and think about that. Do your kid know where to call you if there is an emergency somewhere else than the house? That type of small thing that people just don't do, and that happened to be to have tremendous implications the day after a major earthquake, flood, or hurricanes.
Yeah, you know, I think that's an excellent point, and it comes up from time to time, and we do here in our part of Illinois. Maybe where we live in our town, maybe flooding is not such a big problem, but, you know, we could have a tornado, we could have an ice storm, and that could mean that you could be several days without power, I mean, all sorts of things that could happen. And, you know, we do have to consider the possibility that it is possible we could have an earthquake. You know, these things could happen, and we give people these basic kinds of advice, that there are some really quite simple things that you should do to be prepared. But yet at the same time, people don't do it.
No, you have to repeat that again. I think if you hear something 10 times, you start thinking, oh, maybe if I heard that from 10 different people on a few radio shows and elsewhere, yeah, let's do it. And the other thing we've learned, and we talk about that in the book as well, is people learn from their neighbors, family members. So, you know, if you have done that, just tell your friends. I mean, have a party on Friday night and show them what you've done in your apartment. People learn by experience more than they read, you know. So I think that's one way to go. And the last thing I would like to say on that, don't think that because you're living in the safe areas, nothing would happen to you. Let's say you go on honeymoon in Cancun, and that's the right week, there is a big earthquake.
Yeah.
So when you're traveling, that's the same type of question you have to ask yourself. And we say a few things, and I should mention the website, the book is a website. It's www.theirrationaleconomist.com. That's easy. So we put some information on that website as well.
All right, good. People can look at that. We do have about 5 minutes left. We have some other calls. We'll try to get at least one or two. Next in line is in Urbana and line one.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. It seems to me we have made some progress. Most communities now do have better zoning regulations than they had 50 years ago. There are areas here on our floodplains in the Midwest where there are floods, major floods, every 15, 20 years or so. And yet people insist on building there. I believe it's no longer possible to get insurance for new buildings on at least some of those floodplains, which should help to deter building there. But you started with the problems along the seacoast, where people are building so close to the shore that it's almost inevitable that they will meet with disaster. You didn't, I think, mention that they're also destroying the environment, where I believe it's something like 95% of the life in the ocean begins. These are the spawning beds for even the deep sea areas. And it would make very good sense not to build close to those shorelines, simply to safeguard those environments. But local interests profit so heavily from building in those areas that it's almost impossible for even state governments to zone them properly. So what I'm arguing for is that there has to be national guidance. It seems to me that one of our problems today is the Reaganomic myth of government being the problem. But very, very often, it seems to me, government is the only answer. Would you care to comment?
Yeah, I would. I think you're right. I didn't mention the impact of urbanization and, you know, advanced construction on the coast. If you take Louisiana as an example, at some point, it's better now, but at some point, we were losing a lot of wetland in Louisiana. I mean, a lot that was like a football stadium area, the size of a football stadium every hour. For like years and years and years. It goes back to the point that Dave mentioned, which is like the Global Risk Report 2010, talking about long-term exposure. It's not like over time, because you build one house, that you're losing all your wetland. But after several decades of doing that, obviously the wetland that usually play the role of a buffer and protect the country. It's not doing it anymore. So, no, I think that's a great point. You mentioned access of insurance against flood. That's true on paper. In reality, what happened is that even if you don't have flood insurance, well, if you flooded because you decided to build in one of these areas, it would be very hard for the local, state, or federal government not to give you some relief the day after the catastrophe. Politically, that would be very hard. On paper, you would like to do it so people have an incentive not to build in these high-risk areas. In reality, it's very, very hard for the government the day after, given all the emotion, given all the media coverage, not to help people decided to build in these high-risk areas or decided to go without buying some type of insurance to cover the house. So that's a tricky, very tricky situation where unless, again, it goes back to the question of when your listeners talking about tough questions, tough decision we have to make, unless we do that, we won't be better. I think we are getting in the right direction. I tend to agree with you, even if I'm here teaching at the Wharton School, we tend to think that the market can do a lot of things. At the same time, there are things that the market will not be able to do, and that may be a good reason for a government intervention or government help in that case. And building codes and land use regulation makes an enormous difference. We've seen that comparing Haiti and Chile. Two major earthquakes, radically different situation. In one case where there was no land use and building codes, namely Haiti and Chile, where there are building codes. Still a catastrophe, but much less people suffered from the earthquake in Chile.
We're going to have to stop. We're at the end of our time. For people who would like to read more on the subject, however, you can look at the book we've talked about, The Irrational Economist, Making Decisions in a Dangerous World, published by Public Affairs Book. And there certainly is also a website, irrationaleconomist.com, that you can take a look at. And our guest, Dr. Erwin Michel Curjean, is the Managing Director of the Risk Management and Decision Processes Center at the Wharton School at University of Pennsylvania. And one of the projects he's been involved in is the Global Risks Report for 2010, the World Economic Forum has put this out, and Wharton's been involved in this. They've been doing this for a series of years. This is the most recent one. If you're interested in taking a look at that, you can see it on the web as well. Just put in Global Risks Report 2010 to whatever browser you use, and I'm sure that it will find it. And to you, Dr. Michel Curjean, thank you very much for talking
with
us today.
Thank you. That was a great time.